The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them, so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals. Whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation, Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Welcome back to Hashtag Sisters-in-Law with Jill Winebanks, Joyce Vance, Barb McQuaid, and me, Kimberly Atkins-Store. We have a lot to talk about. We don't stop just because it's summertime. So today we're going to talk about efforts to bring ethics to the Supreme Court, the trial of Senator Bob Menendez wrapping up, and we'll take a look at part of Project 2025. We're going to start doing that regularly on this podcast, looking at all the things that would happen if it actually goes into effect. And this week, we're going to look at how it would change some criminal prosecutions in major cities. But first, before we get to that, I'm very excited that the sisters-in-law will be getting together in person again, this time on September 20th, for an evening with the sisters-in-law at the 92nd Street Y. I know that's your old stomping ground, Jill. They used to live in that neighborhood. How excited are you?
I am so thrilled. When I took guitar lessons there while I was in law school, I never thought I'd be a speaker at the 92nd Street Y. Really great audience. It's very exciting. I hope my law school classmates will show up and that Joyce's family, which is large and wonderful, that they will be there. It'll be a wonderful event.
Jill, will you be playing the guitar?
Well, it's sort of like my tennis lessons. I was told to quit. Yeah. I was not successful.
All right. Fair enough. We'll take your legal analysis instead.
You know, you guys, are we going to make a point of getting a corned beef and pastrami as long as we're up in that neck of town?
Absolutely.
I'm down. Yep. I'm definitely down.
Pastrami queen for me.
And so what sports team in New York would you find allegiance with, Barb?
Yeah, this is going to be tricky because, you know, the Detroit sports teams kind of have rivals in all of those places. You know, in Boston, I made an exception because the Celtics were in the playoffs, playing in the NBA finals. So I'm going to have to give this some thought, you know, Yankees and
no.
Well, Barb, while you're thinking about it, girl, I've got something for you that's going to make your day. My youngest told me yesterday that he's thinking about applying to the University of Michigan for business school.
Go Blue!
But it gets worse. One of the things he said was, I really like Michigan football.
Oh. Love it.
I figured that would
Welcome.
Make your day.
Did you disown him, Joyce?
It does make my day.
I said, honey, you will have to get a new mother. Her name will be Barbara Quinn. I knew that.
We'll take him in our household. We'll barely notice an extra one.
So, if you can, join us at the 92nd Street Y on the night of September 20th. You can find tickets at politicon.com/tour, and you can also go to the 92nd Street Y website for more information.
The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com, RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Ethics and the Supreme Court. That feels like quite an oxymoron these days. And you know, it really does break my heart. Joking aside, as someone who's used to respecting the courts, I hate these stories about ethics and the lack of integrity at the court. But here we go, because there's new reporting on Clarence Thomas. I did not think it could get any worse, but it did. Kim, do you want to tell us about it?
Oh my goodness. Like it's at this point, it's almost, I was going to say it's almost comical. It would be comical if it wasn't so sad. So even though Democratic senators have requested all information about Clarence Thomas's trips and you know, junkets, as well as there being a law requiring them, requiring him to disclose them, he somehow just keeps letting some slip through the cracks. So we learned deep in a letter Democratic senator sent to Attorney General Merrick Garland, which we'll get to in a minute, that Clarence Thomas apparently took a free trip to Russia in 2003. So get this, it's a yacht trip, which also included a helicopter flight to the hometown of Vladimir Putin. And guess who paid for it? You get one guess and you would be right. That would be one Harlan Crow. You can't make this stuff up.
It's like the shrine of Vladimir Putin's hometown, right? What good United States Supreme Court justice doesn't go to Russia where compromise is possibly at issue?
They had everything on it. If I have not been to Russia, but I would go the same, if I ever went as a journalist, I would go the same way I went to China, which is take nothing electronic, sign anything, know that you will be watched and monitored everywhere you go, and they probably still have all your information somehow. Can you imagine what the Russians have on Clarence Thomas? My goodness.
It's just crazy. Barb Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez introduced articles of impeachment against Justices Thomas and Alito this week. It's largely viewed as a theatrical gesture because of Republican control of the House, but I know you've been interested in the underlying charges and whether they would substantiate impeachment if it was a realistic possibility. Can you talk about whether you think this is more than a stunt?
Yeah, it's definitely more than a stunt. I think, I assume that Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez realizes that it is unlikely that her colleagues in the House will actually go forward and vote to impeach. But there is a basis for it. There are impeachment requires high crimes or misdemeanors. So there are criminal statutes for someone who willfully makes a false statement in an official document. And so on these disclosures that says, these are my official disclosures and here's what I accepted, that is a possibility. I think you would want to find more evidence to demonstrate the willfulness aspect, which means not only did I know I took the trip, not only did I know I didn't report it, but I knew I was legally required to report it. So I think you'd have to find evidence of that beyond just, you know, I didn't know. But it becomes less and less plausible every time there's another one of these and there's outrage elsewhere. There's also another ethics in government statute that does make it a misdemeanor to submit a false statement of gifts that have been accepted. So that could be a basis as well. So I think there's a basis for it. I think, you know, is it plausible that it will pass? No. And so do you not even try because you know it can't prevail? I don't know. I mean, if you had the votes of people who were not just voting in the best interest of their own party. Because if you don't bring it forward and at least show the public what you have, then it kind of normalizes this sort of behavior, right? So I think it's right. And I think this is the method. You know, we may talk in a little bit about the criminal prosecution. I don't know about that, but it seems that impeachment is the best way to remove office holders from the executive branch or the judicial branch who engage in high crimes or misdemeanors. So this seems like, you know, the avenue, but I doubt it will be successful.
You know, I am reminded that Alcee Hastings, one of the few federal judges who faced impeachment and was removed from his job, was impeached during a Democratic administration when Democrats controlled both houses because he had done things that his fellow judges found to be very distasteful. And Congress followed up on that. And that's, I think, is the comparison to not taking these very serious allegations as seriously as they probably should be. So, Jill, that does, I mean, raise this criminal investigation that Barb talked about. Senator Whitehouse and others have asked DOJ. They've sent Merrick Garland a letter asking him to consider opening a criminal investigation. What's the basis for that? And do you think it has merit? Is this something DOJ should be doing?
So contrary to Barbara's implication that maybe criminal was not something that should be pursued, and pointing out the difference, impeachment is a political process. It is not linked to any particular criminal code violation. So it can be anything, including failing to recuse when you have an obvious conflict of interest. That wouldn't be true in a criminal investigation. But here, I think you do have enough. And I would say, you know, Barb, you were questioning, is there enough to show intent and deliberate deliberateness? And I would say, maybe not the first time you failed to disclose, but after you got caught by newspapers and others, and, oh, yeah, I'll report that one. And then you get caught again and you report that a second time, but you didn't do it when you were reporting everything else. You can't deny that he knows the reporting requirement. That's obvious. And I would have to say, if I were a prosecutor, I'd want to look at his tax returns and see whether any of these lavish gifts, I mean, the total is over $4 million worth of value. Did he pay taxes on that? You know, I think at some point you have to say that's something legitimate to look at when you get to this amount of money. So I do think the Department of Justice should do it. I think Senator Whitehouse and Wyden and any others that have joined are correct that it is something that the DOJ should investigate. They may not find the evidence they need, and then they will drop it. But that doesn't mean you don't bring it. And I think, you know, I've known since Watergate the importance of the public disclosure of information and of proceeding and indicting where you have the evidence. I think it's important. I think we could have avoided what's going on in America now if we had indicted Richard Nixon.
You know, it's hard to avoid that conclusion. And I mean, the possible tax violation here, it's serious. If you were a United States attorney or any other federal employee and you failed to disclose $4 million in gifts and account for them on your taxes, do you think that you would get, if not a prosecution, then a very serious investigation? I'm pretty sure you would. I would have opened that case every day of the week because it would have been incumbent upon me as a prosecutor to do my due diligence and make sure either charges, if they were appropriate, were brought, or if they weren't appropriate, that they were bypassed. So Barb may have a different take, but it seems to me I would have looked at it. What do you think?
Yeah, I think I do. You know, Sheldon Whitehouse, and Senator Sheldon Whitehouse and Senator Ron Wyden submitted that letter to Merrick Garland asking for the appointment of a special counsel and cited some cases where public officials were prosecuted criminally for failure to disclose gifts. But it seemed like in all of those, there was also something else going on. You know, there was somebody who accepted a bribe, and this was the charge that they ended up charging them with, because often it's the easy charge. You don't have to prove, you know, any of the other stuff, any of the quid pro quo, and in an effort to, you know, get them out of there. And so, you know, standing alone, I just don't know that this is a criminal case. I think it's a bad look. I think it's an ethical violation. I think impeachment might be appropriate. But you know, just like the Hunter Biden case, it strikes me as it's rare that you bring these sort of standalone tax cases. Usually the tax cases get brought because you're investigating other kinds of crimes, and the tax case ends up being the easy one to prove, you know, the Al Capone theory of prosecution. But I think the amount of the gift is below the threshold that we would have typically charged in my former office simply for tax evasion. I think it's the ethical problem that really bothers me here. And I think ethical problems are best dealt with through, discipline and termination, which is why I think impeachment is a better way to go than criminal. I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm just saying it is not typically how cases are handled and brought. And I'm always reluctant to use a criminal tool against someone in public life just because they are in public life. It's a really hard question to ask yourself. Would this person be charged if they were not in public life? You know, like Hunter Biden.
Of course, Hunter Biden did get charged. Right. I mean, it's sort of like we live in that era. But I think your point is a good one.
Can I be in the middle of you two?
No, I think your point is a fair one.
Yeah.
Let me just say one thing real quick, which is this. I agree with you, Barb. And normally, it's a failure to file. In my old office, we would have treated that as a misdemeanor. But if you filed your taxes and you made material misstatements or failed to disclose tax liability on them, which is sort of what Hunter Biden is charged with in California, then we would have charged felony or misdemeanor as appropriate. And I mean, $4 million in gifts that don't get incorporated onto his taxes, boy, that's a big chunk of change for the average American.
Well, if that's the amount I saw in this most recent allegation is something like $200,000.
No, it was $4.2 million in total gifts. And I want to ask both of you as former U.S. attorneys a question. Would you think that a special counsel is necessary here? Wouldn't you think this would fall within your ability to handle?
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah,
me too. I don't know why they're asking for special counsel. No. They should just refer it to the U.S. attorney.
Yeah,
but okay, yes,
Kim,
I agree with
you
that.
Wanted to
but Kim,
be,
yeah,
oh, sorry,
yeah
go ahead.
I just sort of I'm taking both the points made by Barb and Joyce, and I'm sort of in the middle. I too agree that the fact that somebody is a public figure should not be the decider as to whether charges are filed or not. But I think if you are a public figure in a position where you are affecting other people, right, that you are so susceptible to this kind of flouting of rules when you have a position of public, does that weigh a little more in favor than it would have otherwise? And that's sort of why, like, I take both Barb's and Joyce's point, but I think that there's also a middle ground there, that it depends on what kind of public figure you are, what you're doing, and what this unreported income was about. And I think that that would lean in favor to me of going ahead and bringing the charge, even if there's not an underlying one.
That reminds me of Abe Fortas, who had the decency to step down based on far less serious allegations.
Right?
Exactly, because the Supreme Court works on the public's confidence in its integrity.
Yes.
And Clarence Thomas is like, I don't give a damn. You know, I'm just
you know,
that's
the arrogance, I think, that is one of the things that is so upsetting, right? Is like, what are you going to do about it? You can't make me. So
I mean, maybe
that's a reason to bring a prosecution.
But maybe that's the answer, right? We live in an era where public figures have no shame, whether it's Clarence Thomas or Donald Trump.
Point.
And that means
good
new
point.
Era. All right.
I'm for a prosecution.
It's clear that something is broken at the court. And my question is, you know, is there any hope of fixing it? What do y'all think?
Electing people in the House and Senate who will pass legislation that makes ethics requirements mandatory and not voluntary for the SCOTUS. I mean, that's it.
Amen.
Yeah. And with, you know, that would give you a basis for impeachment for a failure to comply.
Jill, what do you think?
I agree. And I think it's mandatory that we have a new Congress that will take action. The only way that's going to happen is a Democratic House, a Democratic Senate, and a Democrat in the White House.
Yeah, and I would take it one step further and say it's important to make sure that the person who is nominating federal judges and justices for the next 4 years is not Donald Trump. We don't need any more Neil Gorsuches or Matthew Kaczmareks. We need judges who are willing to set aside politics when they sit on the bench and rule on the basis of the facts and the law. And I don't mean to suggest that Democratic nominees are perfect, but by and large, you know, we have not had a Democratic nominee, or rather a democratically appointed judge, have to step down from the bench like a district judge in Alaska had to do last week after allegations of sexual impropriety. We need to start taking the federal judiciary seriously. And I think the court and the courts are on the ballot this year.
And by not letting Donald Trump pick them, Joyce meant not letting the Heritage Foundation choose them, or Leonard Leo, or anybody else.
Sure, absolutely.
The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com, RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
The jury began deliberations on Friday in the trial of Senator Bob Menendez of New Jersey. Menendez is charged with bribery and several related offenses. He's on trial along with two businessmen who allegedly paid those bribes. There's a third co-defendant who pleaded guilty and testified at the trial. Menendez's wife has also been charged in the scheme, but she'll have a separate trial later due to some health concerns that she's having now. So let's bring everybody up to speed. Joyce, let me start with you. We heard 4 days of closing arguments this week. You know, between this case and the Manhattan DA case against Donald Trump, haven't these judges ever heard of time limits? Like, my gosh, this is, don't put these poor jurors through that. Tighten it up. Focus, people. But what was the gist of the prosecution's argument and their theory of the case?
Yeah, well, to your point, Barb, it would not have taken me 5 hours to say this in closing argument like it took the prosecution, because it was a very simple theory. The theory was that Senator Menendez put his power as a United States senator up for sale to the highest bidder. And in some cases, that highest bidder happened to be people who were foreign interests, foreign concerns. It's a really classic case of public corruption, of pay-to-play access. If you want the senator to do stuff for you, you have to bring him the gold bricks. So the government has charged this as a conspiracy, and they offered messages exchanged between Senator Menendez and his wife, Nadine, which show her asking for his instruction. And prosecutors say that's evidence of a conspiracy. The senator wanted to keep his fingerprints off of everything, and that's why you see Nadine Menendez in the mix. the defense, of course, is that this was all on the wife. And, you know, juries don't love it when husbands try to put it all off in the wife. I don't think that's going to be super successful.
Yeah, Kim, let's pick it up there. The defense case for Senator Menendez. What's his story? So we've seen, again, vigorous closing arguments by the defense. Yeah. And what's their argument?
Yeah. I don't know if the listeners can sort of hear my eyes rolling in the background, but listen, you know, it's one of the defenses. The main defense in a nutshell is basically what every defendant has the right to say, which is the prosecution hasn't made its case. The prosecution has not put together the sort of pay to play scheme for bribery that is required. And it is up to the prosecution to make the case. It is not up to the defense to unmake the case. But some of the arguments in how the prosecution failed, I thought were interesting. One, the attorneys for Menendez said, you know, yeah, there was all this cash that they found in the house. But you know what? He's Cuban. And you keep cash in the house all the way back from the senator's father who immigrated here from Cuba with cash stuffed in a clock. That's just a very Cuban way. Now, we have discussed before how some community, some folks, including folks in communities of color, and don't at me. I know that white people do this too. I'm not saying it's exclusive, but it is a very cultural thing for a lot of people to keep cash, you know, whether it's distrust of banks. I'm sure with immigrants that might be something as well. And so I don't discount that. But it's one thing when you're like Fannie Willis with a couple grand on you. It's another thing with the levels of money that we are talking about here. Like, oops, yeah, I just kept that. I just had that laying around, you know. I'm a
$500,000.
What?
And the gold bricks.
I'm gonna get to the gold bricks. But like, you know, what member of the Senate doesn't have?
Who among us?
Hundreds of thousands of dollars just sitting in the house. Okay, it's cultural. Another
and stuffed in shoes.
Envelopes. Another defense is that those gold bars. Those are my wife's. I don't know where she got them. We live different lives. She keeps them in her part of the house. I don't know. It's literally the Alito defense. It's like, you know, my wife enjoys flags. Some people's wives enjoy gold bars. I don't know what is up with that. It's just, I don't know. So it is worth noting that his wife is also charged and she is being tried separately. You do see people sort of throwing one another under the bus when they are defendants.
Yeah, it's a convenient
being
strategy.
Tried
isn't it?
Separately. So yeah, I mean, listen, I just can't see how that would be the thing that prevents a conviction here. If indeed, and I don't know every bit of evidence that the prosecution put on, but if the prosecution made their case, I don't think the I keep hundreds of thousands of dollars in the house because I'm Cuban or those gold bars were my wife's defenses are going to carry the day.
Yeah, you know, and the gold bars too had the fingerprints of a bribe payer, one of the charged bribe payers on them as well, which
I'm sure she was just showing it to him.
Pretty
bad luck.
Came over. Ooh, but can I handle it? Can I touch it?
Although you have to admit, they're also claiming, as they did in his first trial, that they're friends and that this was just stuff between friends. And there is apparently some evidence that both Senator's wife, Nadine, has a long-term relationship with at least one of the co-defendants and that so does he. And it worked at the first trial. So let's not, laugh our heads off here too much.
Look, and it worked for Virginia's governor, right? Who had said that people that paid for my daughter's wedding were friends. And with this Supreme Court and its history of making it tough to do public corruption.
Snyder. Just look at Snyder.
Exactly. I mean, no criminal
conviction
is safe
with these guys. This is actually
a pretty common defense
in a public corruption case because you got to explain away the money. And so, like, oh, yeah, my friend gave it to me. Do you guys have friends like that?
No.
You guys are all good friends.
I wish I did.
Where are my gold bars? That's what I want to know. Why have you never given me a gold bar? Well, Jill, I want to ask you about something different. As you well know, sometimes the cover-up is worse than the crime, right? That's what they said about Watergate back in the day. Remember when presidents could still be charged with crimes? Too soon. A superseding indictment was filed in this case. You know, it was originally filed, the case was filed in, back in September, and then in March, there was a superseding indictment to add charges for obstruction of justice. How do prosecutors use obstruction evidence to prove up the underlying crime? Like, what about that makes the cover-up worse than the crime in some cases?
So the original indictment was only 4 counts, separate conspiracies to do different violations. And then they got charged with 12 more in the obstruction area. And obstruction is very helpful in proving the underlying crime because why are you hiding it if you didn't do it? And so it shows intent, motivation, and that's why it becomes so important. The thing that happened right before the superseding indictment is there was originally the senator and Mrs. Menendez and three co-defendants. One of the three co-defendants flipped and pled guilty and then started cooperating. So they had his testimony, and that's, I think, what led to the sufficient evidence to bring these additional obstruction charges. And obstruction, just like in Mar-a-Lago, the obstruction sort of proves you weren't innocent to begin with because you wouldn't have done it if you hadn't been guilty to begin with.
Yeah, and the old consciousness of guilt, right?
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, back in Watergate, actually, the crime at that time, the original crime, was a break-in at the DNC headquarters. A failed one, because as they were there, they were seen by the police and pulled out before they did anything. But that was a pretty minor crime compared to what's charged here, which is actual bribery. And so I think that here the obstruction may be really bad, but the underlying crime is pretty terrible too.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. No. Good point. But it's almost like a gift to prosecutors, isn't it?
Oh,
I always
is.
Thought like, oh, thank you. You know, the original case may not have been so strong, but now you've done something to cover it up.
Yeah.
That's itself a crime and evidence of the first crime. So it's a gift to prosecutors. Joyce, I have a question for you. This caught my eye. Yours, no doubt, as well. If Menendez is a senator from New Jersey, and these people live in New Jersey, why is this case being prosecuted by the Southern District of New York?
Isn't this an interesting question? It was the first thing that grabbed my attention when the original, the first of the three versions of this indictment was handed down. Here's the answer. The U.S. attorney in New Jersey was a witness in the case because Menendez had communications with him while he was being vetted to become the U.S. attorney. He actually wanted him to protect the senator's friend, real estate developer Frank Davies, who allegedly was bribing Senator Menendez. He wanted to keep him from being investigated for bank fraud. And so the U.S. attorney, who's now the sitting U.S. attorney, Philip Selinger, had no wrongdoing involved here. He simply took that in and protected his office from any suggestion that their investigation should be altered in any way. But he, of course, recused as a result of those conversations. The case went to the U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York to oversee. That's what often happens. For instance, I had cases where the U.S. attorney in Montgomery had to recuse, and so I would pick up her cases for her. That's pretty common in these recusal situations. What was a little bit different here was that because some of the meetings in this case, the meetings between co-conspirators occurred at restaurants in Manhattan, once the Southern District took over the investigation, they realized that they could indict in their district.
Yeah.
And they did
that.
And I think it's a good call here, by the way, because it gets the prosecution of the case out of the district that Senator Menendez represents, the District of New Jersey, which is one federal district.
So wait,
I actually agree in the end. It's probably
the
right call.
District attorney, the U.S. attorney, would have been a witness in the case with these Did like Tony Soprano walk in? Like, this is like the craziest.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
This is the craziest.
It is.
Story.
You know, and also the Attorney General of New Jersey, right? Who was also approached. Menendez had no shame.
Oh, there's an allegation that he tried to influence both a state AG case and a case in the U.S. Attorney's office. So I agree with you. I think moving it to Manhattan makes a lot of sense. It's not the usual Bigfoot move, Preet Bharara, if you're listening. no, it makes a lot of sense. So Kim, here's a question that's half in jest, but only half. If Senator Menendez committed these crimes in his official capacity, which it sounds like he did, right? He took official acts. Why isn't he entitled to immunity from prosecution? I mean, is that a thing? Senatorial immunity?
He tried it. He argued that he did have immunity from these claims. He said both the speech and debate clause, which protects lawmakers in carrying out of their duty, as you said, and also the doctrine of separation of powers prevented his prosecution. You know, the big bad executive branch cannot come after a little old senator like him, prevented these charges. And a judge said in March, you got to be kidding me. Like, no, bribery is not a job of a lawmaker.
Right?
And of course, it can be prosecuted. It can be prosecuted like anybody else. It's not overreached by the executive. So he tried it. He tried it and he lost.
I think after this Trump case, though, they're going to, like, everybody's going to try this, right? I mean, and or you can't use the evidence of my official
now
acts.
That
because he did commit official acts.
That might be. I'm less worried about wide grants of immunity, but I am worried about the evidentiary spillover from this terrible opinion.
It's crazy, right? I mean, it shows how bad the Supreme Court's decision in Trump v. U.S. was.
Yeah, I think it's going to take us years to realize all the different ripple effects that it has as we see it, how it changes our assumptions of so many things. Well, let me ask you, Jill, you mentioned a prior case. This, as you said, is not Menendez's first rodeo. He was charged with bribery once before. Can you tell us about that case and how that turned out for Menendez?
Yeah, it turned out pretty good for him, actually. It was a case involving someone he said was a close friend who was a dentist. And he claimed that these were just gifts from a friend. And of course, the Supreme Court in Snyder has said, yeah, gifts, you know, that don't precede the act that you're supposed to do, those are just gratuities. They're like tips, and that's okay. You have to pay somebody and specifically say, in exchange, you have to do this. And I mean, that's a serious problem, and it's been going on, as we've said. The governor of Virginia got away with it. And so he was acquitted by a jury and apparently didn't learn his lesson and went about business where he has all this cash and all these gold bars. Don't forget the $60,000 Mercedes-Benz or the mortgage payment that all add up to over $4 million and $500,000 in cash. So I think he felt like he got away with it once. It's worth going to trial to see if he can get away with it again.
Allegedly.
Yes, allegedly.
Got to make sure you get that in there. Well, let me just ask all of you this question. Curious about your thoughts. You know, Donald Trump and his supporters have argued that Joe Biden has weaponized the Department of Justice to use it to go after his political rivals. Does the prosecution of a Democratic senator help refute that claim in any way? What do you guys think?
So let me start. I want to start because I testified before the weaponization subcommittee of the Judiciary Committee, which is now called the Lawfare Committee, which is a strange use of the word lawfare. But anyway, there is no weaponization. So let's just dispel that wrong statement to begin with. There is no evidence of it. And certainly to me, the proof is that Hunter Biden has been indicted and tried, and so has Senator Menendez. And I just think you can't possibly consider it to be weaponized if the Department of Justice under President Biden is going after people who commit felonies or misdemeanors, regardless of their
party. Don't forget Congressman
Henry
Cuellar.
They get indicted.
Yes,
Henry Cuellar.
Democrat.
We can go through a list. Another Democrat. So yeah, I think this does disprove the weaponization. And that committee, by the way, has not come up with anything that would even remotely look like it was a weaponized Department of Justice. They've gotten nowhere, any more than the impeachment investigation of President Biden has gotten anywhere. So I think it's pretty much a ridiculous claim.
I mean, can we just say, you know, that Jim Jordan, who's been really big on this whole notion of weaponization of government, is a failed lawyer. He went to law school, never passed the bar,
never practiced, you know, doesn't know anything about prosecuting cases. And this attitude that his party has assumed is a real affront to the career people at the Justice Department, the people who keep their heads down and keep us safe day in and day out, along with their brothers and sisters in law enforcement at the FBI, DEA, ATF, and the Marshals Service. And I'm astonished that the so-called party of law enforcement is permitted to get away with this. There is no weaponization of the Justice Department, but if you want to find out what weaponization looks like, then read Project 2025, because Donald Trump and the Heritage Foundation, they will weaponize DOJ.
Yeah, it seems like a little bit of projection going on here, right?
It's always projection.
Good
always.
Idea, yes.
Accusations of weaponization. Yeah, and, you know, Joyce, like you, I just want to say a word in defense of all of the incredible professionals who work at the Department of Justice, whether it's the FBI or U.S. Attorney's Offices or Maine Justice. They are nonpartisan. They're not bipartisan. They're nonpartisan. They just, it's part of the principles of federal prosecution that is impermissible to look at politics in making a decision regarding charging. And, you know, the people who work in those offices are just not political. They're looking at facts and law and prosecuting people regardless of political party. And so this idea that somehow Joe Biden has weaponized the Department of Justice, I mean, he's hands off. He has followed the memos that have existed since Watergate that says, you know, presidents don't direct the Department of Justice. It's an effort to have independence.
You know, if he tried to, the career folks at DOJ who, you know, by the way, no secret, right? DOJ folks and law enforcement folks tend to lean a little bit conservative, especially the law enforcement folks. If there was any effort to weaponize, those folks would be up in arms at a minimum resigning. And so this suggestion that Biden has somehow turned the Justice Department into his personal tool, it's just way off base.
And most of those people are career prosecutors who serve under Democrats and Republicans without any change in their perception of what constitutes a crime. And, you know, when I was testifying, I was going to have to be questioned by Jim Jordan. And I just wondered in advance, I was really worried how I would react.
But did you climb over the table and go after him? Jill?
I didn't, but I was wearing a jacket. He wasn't, but I was.
The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Today, we are starting a series of discussions where the sisters-in-law will analyze the content and meaning of the words of Project 2025 and the Republican 2024 platform that echoes Project 2025. But because Project 2025 is over 900 pages, we're going to analyze it in digestible bites. Today, we're going to talk about one section from the chapter about the Department of Justice, Chapter 17, and it's one that Kim selected for our discussion. It's about the prosecution of violent crimes, but I assure you we are going to discuss many other parts of this chapter going forward and all the other chapters, including things like eliminating the civil service, career professionals, hiring loyalists, eliminating the lawyers for the FBI and the chief officer, which is Andrew Weissman's old job. So I know that a lot of people are going to care about that elimination. But before we get to Kim's specific question, I just want to put things in context and make sure that everybody's up to speed on Project 2025. The full document is for the transition that the conservatives expect when Donald Trump is the next president, something that, of course, we hope won't happen, but in case, it's a plan for the first 180 days and beyond. I consider it extreme in its transformation of our government. And so, Joyce, can you give me some examples of its broad outlines and authors?
Yeah, sure. So Project 2025 is being coordinated by the ultra-conservative Heritage Foundation. They've sort of given it a home. It's a 900-plus page document, as you mentioned. It is written by a series of authors. Every chapter is authored by another conservative luminary, and it reads like a who's who of top conservatives. More than 80% of them served in the Trump administration. A large number of conservative groups are involved and have made contributions to Project 2025. So I think of it, I've sort of evolved my thinking to think of it less as a Heritage Foundation project and more as an all of the most conservative movements in the country's work of their combined hopes and dreams for America. And it's very simply a plan for transforming our three branches, our co-equal branches of government, into a unitary presidency with a powerful executive aided by a compliant Supreme Court, permits that president to marshal his power to implement long-term conservative policies like a national ban on abortion, the end of a merit-based federal bureaucracy in favor of one that has to show loyalty to a new conservative president, and a wave of massive deportations, they say, on day one, of people who are alleged to be here without legal status. You know, there's something for everybody to hate in this. For instance, it also calls for an end to programs like Head Start and a decrease in funding for special education. So, I mean, really, if you read this document long and deep, you're going to find something not to like. I think what they're counting on is that few people will read all 900 pages. And it's written sort of in this very neutral terminology where you might think, oh, well, that sounds okay. It's just a policy difference. Or maybe it would be good to deport illegal aliens who are stealing American jobs. But when you read it on a deeper level, you come to understand how oppositional it is to fundamental American values. The authors include people like Ken Cuccinelli, who served Donald Trump as his head of DHS for the last 2 years of his administration, even though he was never confirmed. There's also Gene Hamilton, who wrote the chapter on transforming DOJ into a political tool that a president could wield against his enemies. Hamilton was at DOJ and played a role in creating the family separation policy and ending DACA for kids. So look, I've been writing about Project 2025 in my newsletter, Civil Discourse, since last November when it first caught my eye. I am really glad we're going to take this on in these bite-sized morsels because that's the best way to understand it. But Project 2025 as a whole is deeply disturbing. It is not consistent with my vision of an America where the government is supposed to protect our rights and create a country of equal opportunity and inclusiveness for all people, instead of just people who adopt a conservative line on political and religious beliefs.
Yeah, it's a terrifying document. It ends birthright citizenship, calls for a national abortion ban, full enforcement of the Comstock Act. And you didn't mention Peter Navarro, who's an author of this document. Peter Navarro, who is now in jail, but was the trade advisor to the Trump administration. And the Secretary of Defense, the person who was the Secretary of Defense on January 6th, when troops were not called out in a timely fashion, and who Victor, she and I interviewed on iGen Politics in one of our most outstanding interviews ever, something everybody should listen to. And let's not forget, Ben Carson is an author as well. We remember all of those people, but Barb, given the relationship of people that we've mentioned, and by the way, Jean Hamilton works for the foundation run by Stephen Miller, one of our all-time favorite people in the Trump administration, and who I sat next to when I was testifying before the weaponization committee. Is Trump being truthful when he says he knows nothing about the document or its creators?
Yeah, no, not at all. I think what's going on is that he has seen that it's getting a lot of attention lately, and people are noticing it and reading it and horrified by it. And so he's trying to distance himself from it. But he said at a Heritage Foundation dinner in April of 2022, this is a great group, and they're going to lay the groundwork and detail plans for exactly what our movement will do and what your movement will do when the American people give us a colossal mandate to save America. So he's very much in bed with the Heritage Foundation. And Project 2025 is, you know, led by Kevin Roberts at the Heritage Foundation. And he has said something like, our efforts will be bloodless if the left allows it to be. I mean, yeah, my gosh, that's terrifying. I mean, it really suggests that, you know, this, if necessary, it will be, violence will be used. But Project 2025 is backed by more than 100 conservative organizations, many of which are led by close allies of Donald Trump. One of them is the Claremont Institute, which was, of course, John Eastman's former employer. Yeah. That was the architect of the fake electors.
All the best team. People.
America First Legal, which is, as you mentioned, led by Stephen Miller, who was a former Trump advisor, who was the immigration hawk in his administration. And there are a number of former Trump administration officials involved in Project 2025. His former Office of Management and Budget Director, Russ Vogt, is a leading proponent of it. Former Acting Defense Secretary Christopher Miller, Jill, I know you had him on Intergenerational Politics, and he melted down. Ben Carson,
he screamed at Victor. He was going to walk off after Victor asked one question. Victor was 18 years old at the time.
Good for Victor.
Yeah, what a big man.
You know, Ben Carson, as you mentioned, was the HUD director under Trump, and Rick Dearborn, who was the deputy chief of staff under Donald Trump. So he's got very close allies all over this. And, you know, just a word about the Heritage Foundation and who they are. We just quoted Kevin Roberts, who's their president, who said that, you know, this thing about bloodless if the left allows it to be. The Heritage Foundation was created in, you know, the 70s or 80s by business interests who tried to come up with sort of policy pretexts for, to roll back regulations in the Reagan administration. And they were all designed to help business, you know, deregulating environmental rules that were there to, you know, in the 70s, you know, Nixon and others were very favorable for environmental regulations because they wanted to save the planet and protecting our air and water and ADA rules and civil rights rules and other things. And the Heritage Foundation said, this is ruining business. This is terrible for business. And so the Coors family was a big donor, and other big business, you know, billionaires created the Heritage Foundation to give cover to lobbying and policy to try to protect the interests of big business in government. And that is who is pushing this agenda with the Heritage Foundation now, as well as these, you know, ultra-right close allies of Donald Trump.
Great. Thank you. So with that background in mind, I want to move to Kim's question. And I will also say we're going to put a link to Project 2025 in our show notes. If you only even just look at the names of the 30 chapters and who wrote them, you will get some idea, and skim the first paragraph or two, you will know what rights you would be losing if this became the agenda for a future conservative presidency. But Kim, why don't you tell us about the part you selected for us to analyze today, and tell us why and what you think is problematic about it so that we can help talk you off the ledge today.
Good luck.
No talking off the ledge on this one.
We have seen for 4 years of Donald Trump's presidency and years after and the entire campaign before, one of his favorite subjects was you got to get these inner cities under control. You got to get these places like Philadelphia, Chicago, Detroit. They're hell holes, and you'd really need the federal government to clamp in. And if I can do that. So essentially, this gives some teeth to that favorite Donald Trump policy. What it would do would be to have the Department of Justice, the federal Department of Justice, devote considerable resources in monitoring what the prosecutions of violent crimes are in urban centers, in major cities, right? So this isn't going to be happening everywhere. And they're not going to be looking in your small town, you know, at your small town sheriff or DA. They're going to be looking in cities. I'm going to guess at the top of the list will be Detroit, Milwaukee, Philadelphia, and Atlanta, just a hunch, to see what kind of prosecutions are being brought. And if they deem that violent crime is not being sufficiently prosecuted, the first thing they will do is to direct the federal prosecutors to get in there and bring as many federal charges that are on the books that could apply to these cases. So sort of backseat prosecuting by federal folks. But they won't just stop there. They also promise to bring legal charges against local officials, including DAs, who are using their discretion to try to bring down the over-prosecution of folks in certain groups, such as we've known there have been efforts in Boston and elsewhere to try to stop the over-prosecution of Black folks, Brown folks, Indigenous folks, LGBTQ folks, in those areas to bring more equity. If they do that, not only will they not be able to do that, but they could face legal trouble if they actually try to do that. What this seems to me is, to the extent possible, that they're trying to federalize criminal prosecutions in places where they think Black, Brown, LGBTQ folks are, to put more of them in jail. And to sort of give just really vicious teeth to this tough on crime policy that Donald Trump loves. And all of this, by the way, at the time that this was drafted, completely ignores the fact that violent crime in all but a couple of cities is down. It is down. It is not up. So this is a solution without a problem. It is hateful. It is racist, and I think it is more than a little bit driven by sort of a payback from the social justice movement that happened during Donald Trump's administration, where, you know, groups like Black Lives Matter brought to the attention the brutality that Black and Brown people often face. It's payback. They thought those people were terrorists, and now they're going after them.
Yeah, I mean, this is already happening in Florida. At least two independently elected state's attorneys who ran on a platform of what they would and wouldn't go after were relieved of their duties by the governor under some weird theory that he didn't like that they weren't prosecuting minor drug crimes. So this is not what you want to have happen. But Joyce, let's look at what Kim has, you know, the part that she has referred us to. And I want you and Barb, and then Kim, yeah, you've sort of already weighed in, but if you think of something else you want to add. But Joyce and Barb, go ahead and give us your analysis of the meaning of this, whether it's needed, whether is this one. Joyce, you said it. Go ahead and give us your analysis of this.
Yeah. So, I mean, look, here's the bottom line. The way that you can tell that this policy is, as Kim says, mean-spirited and not connected to law enforcement priorities is this notion of prosecuting the prosecutors who don't do what the conservatives at the Heritage Foundation want them to do. That's not how law enforcement works. Look,
as a prosecutor, one of my jobs, in fact, when Eric Holder was the U.S. attorney, he directed all of his U.S. attorneys, all 93 of us across the country, to sit down with our state and local partners and to talk with them about their priorities and what assistance did they need from us. And so there were cases where I did violent crime prosecutions. I did a major one in Tuscaloosa because the chief said to me, we need your help. We need you to do some gun prosecutions to give us the space that we need to make our streets safe. I did that at their request. Here's what Project 2025 says, and I quote, it says, a disturbing number of state and local jurisdictions have enacted policies that directly undermine public safety, leave doubt about whether criminals will be punished, and weaken the rule of law. And that's just bunk. No law enforcement official ever says, I want to undermine public safety. Instead, what's happening is that prosecutors have an enormous amount of discretion to determine what cases they will bring, and they exercise it based on what's important in their jurisdiction. State and local prosecutors, mostly elected. They have to be responsive to the will of their voters, and that's what they do. And in some of these counties, they've elected the so-called reformer prosecutors, people who realize that it's better for them to prosecute serious crime than stuff like marijuana possession, people who use data-driven best practices that permit them to do things like decide that some people who've committed first offense nonviolent crimes can be best rehabilitated by practices other than prosecution. And this is what the Heritage Foundation and the folks behind Project 2025 are objecting to. They don't want to see data-driven best practices. Instead, they want this old-fashioned, tough-on-crime sort of approach. And the bottom line is this, it's not their call to make. Prosecution priorities are set by local prosecutors, by U.S. attorneys, by folks in those jurisdictions. And this idea that the feds should be looking over the shoulder of state and local prosecutors and setting their priorities for them, that's about as far away from the traditional states' rights views of conservatives as you can get. It really, I think, is just like waving a big red flag saying, this isn't about good law enforcement policy. This isn't about making communities safer. This is about making people afraid and ensuring that no one will do anything that's contrary to our Christian nationalist view of how society should function.
Wow. Yeah, I think you raise a really good point there about states' rights. The idea that if state prosecutors are exercising their discretion in a way that the feds don't like, they should be prosecuted. I mean, that is the absolute opposite of federalism and comity and states' rights. But I also think this is a propaganda document. You know, it talks about catastrophic increases in crime, particularly violent crime nationwide. False. Crime and violent crime are down.
Can I just give you one example of that hits close to home for me because my daughter lives there? Four murders year to date in Boston. Four.
And that's one of the cities where you've mm-hmm. had a string of district attorneys in Suffolk County who made it a priority to focus. They do focus on the violent crime, the worst crimes, while also trying to minimize the negative impact of over-prosecution in other communities. They're doing both things at the same
exactly.
time.
Yeah, and can I say why I think this is such a propaganda piece? And I have to believe the people who are writing this actually know better. I mean, one of the things they do is they say the attorney general should direct all U.S. attorneys to sit down with their state and local counterparts and develop a jurisdiction-specific plan. My gosh, Eric Holder did that. Merrick Garland has done that, of course. But the idea that you've got to prosecute every single case that comes across your desk is not realistic because you have finite resources, and so you have to prioritize. In my former office, we had the capacity to do about 1,000 cases a year. Now, if we're doing every immigration case, not based on whether they're violent or a risk to national security, but just if they happen to be here without documentation, that's a case. okay, we got $9.99 left, which how do you want us to use them? Or they talk about prosecuting every case of illegal drug possession. Okay, you want to do that? Then that means there's a lot of other big cases that we are not going to get to that are far more dangerous, taking down, you know, large criminal organizations. And so typically the way the work gets divided in these meetings where you coordinate between federal and state prosecutors is the state handles the street crimes that are most serious, homicides, arsons, home invasions, rapes, very serious crimes. And then the feds take on the big organizational cases, large gangs, carjacking rings, drug cartels. Those are the big cases, but, you know, national security threats, corporate fraud, public corruption cases. And so does that mean some little cases fall between the cracks? Yeah, but, you know, somebody's possessing, you know, one marijuana cigarette somewhere. You just don't have the resources to do all those. But I think a real tell in here is it consistently talks about the left with a capital L as if there is one monolithic enemy that, you know, the next conservative president ought to be targeting. And I think that is very telling about the way this document is being used as propaganda to try to drive a wedge between Americans who perceive themselves as a member of the right and the left with no nuance in between.
And if we just could advise everyone who's going to read or skim this to look closely at, is there any example, any statistic, any fact that supports their broad conclusions? Because every chapter says this is the worst that's ever been. Crime rate is up. But they never show you that it is. And I looked the footnotes. If you read the footnotes, you still don't get that. And so it is, I think, and Barb is our expert on propaganda. This is a propaganda tool, and it's the kind of thing that you might fall for if you don't think about what they're alleging without any background, any support, any fact. It's just not true. So it's really a document that I look forward to having many more discussions about, because every page, I mean, we could have 900 episodes on just this, because as you can see, we talked about basically one paragraph. And it was a rich and robust conversation that should alert you to how bad everything else is.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal, $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Now the time has come for what is really our favorite part of the show, and that's answering your questions. If you have a question for us, you can email us at sistersinlaw@politicon.com or you can tag us on your socials and we will pick three to answer every week. And if we don't pick one of yours, keep an eye on your socials because we often will be in there answering them directly. I've been on Threads a little more than I usually am lately. And so we will try to do that. So our first question comes from Diane, who asks, I have seen several people suggest that Jack Smith issue a superseding indictment to indict all of the co-conspirators since the case will not make it to trial before the election. Thoughts? Joyce, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, this is such a great question, Diane, because I've been having this conversation with a lot of my colleagues who are former prosecutors. And I don't think that there's strong agreement on this one. I think people see value in doing it both ways. I'll just tell you that personally, my view is this. Prosecutors only have to supersede an indictment if they're changing it. For instance, if they're adding new charges, like what we've discussed in the Menendez indictment or in other cases where new and additional charges have been brought. Here, I think the notion is that prosecutors would actually narrow the charges as a reaction to the Supreme Court's decision. And you can simply do that by advising the judge you won't move forward with certain charges. But the reality in this case is it'll likely be more about what evidence can be used. And that certainly wouldn't require any superseding. So Smith certainly might, if he wanted to make it cleaner. One advantage to superseding might be going back to the grand jury and making sure that the grand jury didn't hear any evidence of official acts when they made the decision about whether to indict. That's sort of a hyper-technical issue, but it's possible. In fact, it's likely that Donald Trump will argue that that taints the grand jury's decision to indict. I think it's a bad argument. They won't succeed with that. But it would certainly short-circuit Judge Chutkan having to deal with it if they superseded. So we might see Smith come back and do that. But there are reasons on both sides to do or to not do. So I think it's an interesting question to flag now, and we'll continue to follow it.
Up next, Patty Fink asks, would you and the hashtag sisters-in-law team walk through the chronology of Watergate as it unfolded under the new SCOTUS immunity ruling? That sounds like a question for the Watergate girl.
Well, I love the question, and I did write something for MSNBC, which I can put in the show notes today, about this exact question. And the short answer is Richard Nixon would have served out his full term. He would not have committed any crimes if SCOTUS had already ruled this way when he was president. He would have loved it. And that's too bad. Everything that the president does that falls in official acts, core official acts, is totally immune. And then there's the category of everything else he does that is official but not in core responsibilities like control of the FBI and the Department of Justice and the Department of Defense. Those are core responsibilities because they're specifically designated in the Constitution. But everything else falls into, is it official? And while I think we've already mentioned today that, you know, you can't imagine some of the things like writing checks to pay off a porn star to keep her quiet could possibly be official. That has to be personal. A lot of things you could argue would be within the official category, and then you'd have to have a presumption that the prosecutor would have to overcome that it falls within immunity. And a lot of this was done by campaign officials. Those would clearly not be in official conduct. So I think there would have been a part of the case that could have gone forward. His conversations with Attorney General Mitchell, no. But by the time the crime was committed, Attorney General Mitchell was campaign chairman Mitchell. And so that would have been candidate Nixon taking that action, not President Nixon. So again, I think there would still be something that would be left. The problem that I worry about more than anything is that when these things get decided by a district court judge saying, yes, this is personal and you can prosecute for this, it's going to get appealed up to the Supreme Court, which I think is taking a pretty liberal view of what falls into that presumptive immunity category. And it's going to be hard to predict what they're going to say. Oh, no, that falls within, you know, yeah, he didn't call out the troops on January 6th, but that would have required that he talk to his Secretary of Defense. And so it's definitely core responsibility. It's totally immune. So that's what I worry about going forward.
And our final question comes from Ninja Cat Cheryl. Great name. Does the complete immunity SCOTUS appears to have granted Trump also limit or eliminate the possibility of presidential impeachment? Barb, what do you think?
Yeah, absolutely not. I suppose that's what's coming next. But I think that this is what Chief Justice Roberts has in mind for the way to hold a president accountable and the only way for misconduct in their official conduct. The problem I have with this is that impeachment has been rendered somewhat meaningless in our current age. And that's why it seems so either naive, if not duplicitous, to suggest that, you know, a president should not be criminally prosecuted for official acts, because, of course, we've got impeachment for that. But impeachment requires that the House impeach, you know, charge, and that the Senate convict by a two-thirds vote. And in our hyper-partisan times, it is hard to imagine that you could see that two-thirds vote, because it's going to require in the Senate, you know, it's been pretty evenly split in recent years, that you would have to have a significant number of the president's own party vote to convict on impeachment. And, you know, I just don't know that we're going to see that happen. Can you imagine Republican senators having the courage to convict a President Trump who gets impeached at an impeachment trial? I just don't think so. And so I think even though the impeachment clause, I think, is alive and well, I think it is because it is so, it has become so neutered that I don't think it is sufficient to hold a president accountable.
Well, thank you for listening to Hashtag Sisters-in-Law with Jill Winebanks, Joyce Fans, Barb McQuaid, and me, Kimberly Atkins-Store. Remember to mark your calendars. Hashtag Sisters-in-Law will be doing a live show at the 92nd Street Y in New York City on September 20th. You can get tickets at politicon.com/tour or at the 92nd Street Y website. We look forward to seeing you there. And please show some love for this week's sponsors, Thrive Cosmetics, OneSkin, Blue Land, and Honeylove. Their links are in the show notes. Please support them because they make this podcast possible. Also, follow Hashtag Sisters-in-Law on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And please give us a 5-star review. It really helps other people find the show. Can you believe it? There are still people who don't listen. But, you know, it helps. Give us 5 stars. See you next week on another episode. Hashtag Sisters-in-Law.
Kim is actually on vacay.
I can't be president.
All right, I'm going to try again.
That was just so funny.
I'm going to try again. Sorry. I can't be president either.
Pumpernickel. Again, I cannot be president because the wrong words come out. I'm distracted by Bella, who's trying Bella to make an escape. Can you see? Hang
maybe
on.
That's Biden's maybe I problem. Should. He's got Major looking around. He's afraid he's going to bite somebody.
Come here, baby. Come here. Come here. Can you come stay with mommy? Come stay with mommy.
It sounds okay if you... Joyce, you said it. I can't be president either. Sorry. Okay, that was my first mistake today. Okay.
Well, so, you're the most qualified.
Anyway, you two are always confused.
You're the most qualified of us, Jill. So there's that. You only made one mistake.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Since 2011, American Giant has been making everyday clothing with extraordinary effort. Not in far-off factories, but right here in the USA. We obsess over fabrics, fit, and details, because if you're going to wear it every day, it should feel great and last for years. From the cut of a hoodie to the finishing of a seam, nothing is overlooked. Our supply chain is tight-knit and local, which means less crisscrossing the country and more care in every step. The result is durable clothing, t-shirts, hoodies, sweatpants, and denim that become part of your life season after season. This isn't fast fashion. It's clothing made with purpose by people who care as much about how it's made as how it fits. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.